Both sides ready to proceed? How much time would you wish to retain for rebuttal?
I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for
rebuttal,
please.
3 minutes? Okay. And you can get started whenever you're ready.
Okay. Good afternoon, and may it please the Court. My name is Jessica Whalen, Chief Deputy Solicitor General for the State of Nevada. This is a consolidated appeal presenting first a question of statutory interpretation as to whether a Chapter 604A lender may refinance a so-called exception loan with another exception loan. The relevant statute, NRS 604A 5057 subsection 2, which I'll refer to simply as subsection 2, neither expressly permits nor prohibits the practice. The district court, when presented with competing interpretations by my client, the Financial Institutions Division, or FID, and Dollar Loan Center, or DLC, agreed with Dollar Loan Center, concluding that its interpretation was correct and that a lender may refinance one exception loan with another. Apparently, this practice can be done without limit. That conclusion was an error and would lead to absurd results in conflict with both the plain language of the statute and the broad protective policy of Chapter 604A. The second issue I will address is that of attorney's fees. Obviously, if this court reverses on the merits, then the award of attorney's fees and costs falls by the wayside as DLC is no longer a prevailing party. However, even if the court affirms on the merits, it should reverse the award of attorney's fees for two reasons. First, contrary to what the district court found, FID's defense in this action was not frivolous. Moreover, this court should hold that attorney's fees are unavailable in a preemptive declaratory suit against a state agency where fees would not be permitted in an action governed by Chapter 233B. Starting with the merits, this court, of course, reviews statutory interpretation, a question of law de novo. And the starting point for statutory interpretation is the plain language of the text of the statute, and the goal of statutory interpretation is to discern the intent of the legislature. And as I stated, there's no express prohibition on serial refinancing of exception loans. When you read subsection 2's requirements, however, it's clear that the legislature's intent was not to permit serial refinancing. There's a restriction in subsection 2A4 that interest on an exception loan must not accrue after the date of maturity of the loan. So let's say a lender does a subsection 2 refinance of a high interest loan made under NRS 604A0703. The new exception loan provides for a term of 180 days. The lender then on day 150, the lender does a second subsection 2 refinance of the exception loan and provides for a new term of 180 days. The lender has effectively found a way around the prohibition in subsection 2A4 that interest may not accrue past the 180 days of the first exception loan. Interest will now accrue for a total of 330 days from
the proceeds of a new loan are used to pay the prior loan, then you're no longer accruing interest on the prior loan. Aren't you accruing interest on the new loan now?
You are accruing interest on the new loan, but to the extent that there would be any outstanding interest on the first exception loan, I would assume that would roll into the principal of the second loan and then extend, you know, then you'd be paying interest on interest, and there's a sort of compounding effect.
Wouldn't that be true even in the first subsection 2 loan?
In the first subsection 2 loan that refinances an original high interest loan, yes, that's the case, but that the legislature has provided for that. And the legislature has said it's permissible to refinance an original loan, or I believe the statute says an outstanding loan,
right,
with an exception loan. However, once you've made that exception loan, there is the prohibition in subsection 2A4 that says interest cannot accrue beyond the maturity date of the exception loan. There's not a similar prohibition on that when we're talking about the original high interest loan under section 0703.
So you're reading subsection 2A4 as referring to the interest isn't accruing after the maturity date of the exception loan or the subsequent takeout loan?
Yes, yeah. The loan that is refinanced by virtue of Section 5057.
So then if a subsection 2 loan is then replaced by a new subsection 2 loan, why wouldn't that same principle apply? So it doesn't prohibiting no interest on the new exception loan after the maturity date.
It would on the new exception loan, but what you're doing is effectively circumventing 2A4 with respect to that first exception loan. Because in my example that I gave, after that first 180 days runs, there would be no interest that would continue to accrue under that first exception loan. But if it's refinanced on day 150, all of a sudden the consumer is now paying interest, not for 180 days, but for 330 days. So it keeps the borrower paying interest beyond that original term of the first exception loan. And that's what's impermissible.
But counsel, why wouldn't the legislature just say that? I mean, in subsection 1, it's very clear. It clearly outlines the terms and conditions of refinancing or getting a loan to pay off your first loan, and there's certain conditions and restrictions put on that. There's no similar references or restrictions or directives about that here, and why wouldn't the legislature just say, put in a line that says you can't refinance an exception loan with another exception loan? why wouldn't they just say that?
Sure, I think that would be ideal from our perspective if the legislature had done that. But I think at the time there were trade-offs going on in the passage of Assembly Bill 384, and it's, you know, we don't know exactly what happened there, why the legislature didn't put that in, but I do think implicit in the plain language of subsection 2A4 is that, you know, we have this requirement that interest stop accruing at the maturity date, and we can't just perpetually extend the maturity date to get around that provision. So that's why FID's interpretation reasonably comports with the plain language of the statute. Legislative history also supports this interpretation. DLC claims that legislative history can only be used as an interpretive tool if a statute is ambiguous, and it claims that the statute is unambiguous in its favor. However, this court has in the past referenced legislative history to interpret statutes that it deemed unambiguous. And the best example of this is the DLC 1 case that this court decided in 2018. DLC 1 has been cited extensively by both parties in the briefing, and while there is some disagreement in what that case means, it is instructive here. So there, this court considered whether subsection 2F prohibited a Chapter 604A lender from suing to collect on the recovery of an exception loan. And the court concluded that the plain language of the statute expressly permitted the making of an exception loan, not subject to the restrictions of subsection 1, but that subsection 2 barred a licensee from pursuing civil action. So the court held, and DLC makes much of the fact that this court found that subsection 2F was unambiguous, yet the court still used legislative history to determine the purpose and policy of the statute that it was interpreting. So I'd like to briefly address DLC's argument that FID is somehow stopped or precluded from making its statutory interpretation argument based on arguments it made in DLC 1. As I mentioned, the issue in DLC 1 was extremely narrow. It dealt with the interpretation of subsection 2F and the issue of whether one exception loan could be refinanced with another exception loan simply was not before the court. It was not within the contemplation of the party. The issue truly was whether a licensee could sue to collect civilly on a defaulted exception loan. Reading DLC's answering brief, you would think that FID had flip-flopped regularly on its interpretation of subsection 2, leaving lenders confused about the legal requirements that must follow, but nothing could be further from the truth. Admittedly, FID did not, in the early years after the enactment of Section 5057, prohibit lenders from refinancing an outstanding exception loan with another exception loan. But in 2018, something changed, and that something was this court's opinion in DLC 1. There, the court stressed that Section 5057 has a, quote, protective purpose requiring a liberal construction to effectuate its intended benefits. And one of those intended benefits was ensuring that borrowers do not get called on the so-called debt treadmill. This court stated that an interpretation of the statute that, quote, incentivizes licensees to perpetuate the debt treadmill by making additional loans under subsection 2 with a longer term and a much higher interest rate, end quote, would be contrary to the legislative purpose of the statute. So thereafter, FID reevaluated its position on serial refinancing and determined that allowing the practice was contrary to the protective purpose of Section 5057 that this court reaffirmed in DLC 1. It notified DLC of this change in position in 2020 and 2021, but did not bring any enforcement action against DLC. It simply put in its reports of examination that it recommended stopping the practice. Then in December 2021, FID issued an advisory opinion informing licensees that its position that repeated refinancing of exception loans was not permitted under subsection 2. FID gave plenty of notice to licensees, including DLC, and allowed DLC at least 2 years to change its practice. But instead of abiding by the guidance, DLC initiated this action for declaratory relief under Chapter 30. All this is to say, in roughly 20 years that subsection 2 has been in place, FID changed its position once. And that change in interpretation was not random or based on a whim. It was based on this court's pronouncements in DLC 1. So this brings me to a final point on the merits about agency deference. DLC spends a lot of time talking about Loper-Bright and how it abolished agency deference. While Loper-Bright was certainly a seminal case overturning the federal Chevron doctrine, this court has case law independent of Chevron establishing state grounds for agency deference that survive Loper-Bright. And because of that, where an agency's interpretation is within the language of the statute that it is charged with administering, the agency interpretation is entitled to deference. Here, FID's interpretation is reasonable, comports with the language of the statute, and avoids absurd results. It's not contrary to this court's decision in DLC 1, and the district court erred by failing to defer to FID's reasonable interpretation. If there are no further questions, I'll move on to the attorney fee issue.
Go ahead.
If the court reverses the district court's decision on the merits, as it should, then the award of fees and costs necessarily must be vacated, as DLC would no longer be a prevailing party. However, even if the court affirms on the merits, it should reverse and direct the district court to vacate the award of attorney's fees and costs for two reasons. First, the district court's basis for awarding fees and costs under NRS 18.010 was that FID's defense was frivolous. As I've already discussed in the merits argument, FID had a reasonable basis for its interpretation, largely in response to this court's decision in DLC 1. FID did not take
I'm confused, yes. Because you told us just a few minutes ago about how the issue resolved by DLC 1 was a narrow issue that does not address and resolve the issue here, but now somehow that decision is what opened everyone's eyes and caused the change in position. Can you reconcile that?
Sure. So this court's decision in DLC 1, I don't want to say announced because I don't think it was any kind of new policy, but it reaffirmed that Section 5057 has a protective purpose that must be construed liberally, and that the purpose that for which the legislature passed that statute was in part to alleviate this debt treadmill problem, where customers, borrowers come to a short-term payday lender, they take out one loan, and then in order to make payments on that loan, they have to...
So the agency wasn't previously aware of the reasons for the statute's passage?
The agency certainly was, but bringing that purpose to the forefront caused them to take a step back and reevaluate their policy.
Thank you.
And you believe that we should review that determination deferentially?
I do, yes. Under this court's precedent that Granite Construction is one case, the Sullivan decision is another case, that agencies charged with administering statutes are entitled to great deference, so long as their interpretation is reasonable.
There's different cases, different statements in our law as to the standard that applies. I think they're hard to reconcile. Would you agree?
Without kind of knowing what cases you're referencing, I mean, I think that there are...
Great deference, for example, that phrase is only in a few cases. Others talk about it's a de novo review. What does it mean that an interpretation is within the language of the statute? And how do you put this one that you're fronting now within the language of the statute when it was not the interpretation in 2018 and there was an epiphany with the policy articulated of the debt treadmill and so on? I mean, it's a very ambiguous area to me anyway.
Sure, and those are all questions that this court will obviously have to grapple with, whether it's great deference or just deference. I mean, I think what's clear is this court does have de novo review over the statutory interpretation. It is this court's duty to interpret the statute, determine the legislature's intent. But I think that there's some persuasive value to how an agency views it, and I think it's okay for that view to evolve over time. I think look at the Sullivan case where the state engineer deviated from basin boundaries that were done in the 1960s, and you know, given the change in science and more information coming to light, changed that view. This court said, that's okay, we're going to let you do that.
But emphasizing that there was a huge amount of expertise involved in that determination. Maybe huge amount is too strong, but where there's expertise that's unique. I don't know. It's a hard question under our case law.
Yeah, absolutely. I see my time is running short, so I'll just make one final point, which is that the court should hold in this case that an award of attorney's fees under Chapter 30, which is the Declaratory Judgment Act, is not permissible in a case where a licensee preemptively sues the agency, because if this case were to have proceeded in the ordinary course, the sole remedy for a licensee would have been to proceed under 233B, and attorney's fees are not permitted under Chapter 233B, so there should not be kind of a backdoor into an award of attorney's fees. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Riley.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and may it please the court, counsel. In 2018, this court in DLC 1 held that a lender may refinance a loan issued under NRS 604A.480, but that it may not sue on that loan if the borrower defaults. That holding was based on arguments by the FID that the statute, now Section 5057, was a trade-off of interests. For example, there was no temporal limitation on exception loans under subsection 2. There was no limitation on refinancing, but there was a limitation on the right to sue, and the loan had to be under 200% APR. Within 2 years of obtaining that decision from this court, the FID reversed course in spite of what this court said in DLC 1 and in spite of what they argued to you in that case. I'll submit to this court that this case is not about payday lending, and it isn't even about statutory interpretation, because you have already interpreted the statute. This case is about intellectual consistency, and my client is counting on this court's intellectual consistency in following what it said in DLC 1. The case is also about federalism and separation of powers, and that's why we've asked this court to apply the Loper-Bright doctrine from Loper-Bright Enterprises v. Raimondo, 603 U.S. 369, in this case. This case, the facts of this case demonstrate precisely why an administrative agency should not have heightened deference when it interprets a statute. We have 15 years of interpreting the statute one way. We have 15 years of enforcing the statute one way. And then we have arguments before this court to interpret the statute one way. And all of that changed on a dime when we got a new commissioner. Factually, I do want to clarify one thing. We're talking about refinancing of loans. I don't want there to be any confusion. When we're talking about refinancing of loans, we're not talking about refinancing of distressed loans or defaulted loans. Licensees are not allowed to refinance defaulted loans under NRS Chapter 604A. This has come about when my client has sought to give increased credit limits to customers who are actually paying their bills and who are doing a good job. And what my client could do, I suppose, it could issue a second loan or a third loan to the customer because there's no prohibition on the number of loans. That becomes very complicated and very confusing, not just for the consumer, but for the lender. Which loan am I paying? How much? On what date? It's an administrative mess. And so what my client has done over the years is refinance these loans. There's no harm to the consumer because there's no prepayment of interest penalty. There's no loan origination cost. And the interest rate on these products is always the same.
But so counsel, it doesn't cost. What happens to the interest on that first exception loan, the unpaid interest on that first exception loan, when there is a refinancing of that? Refinancing of the exception loan, the subsection 2 loan, does the interest from the first exception loan get added to the principal of the second loan and then compound in perpetuity, conceivably?
No, it does not, because when the loan is paid off, it stops accruing interest. And so when you refinance the loan, you only have to pay the loan that's actually accrued. That's why a lot of dollar loan center loans are about 13 months long. Most borrowers don't pay out the whole 13 months. They're smart. They know that their interest accrues on a daily basis. So what they might do is, let's say it's the 31st of the month, they haven't gotten their paycheck yet, and they need to pay rent. Well, to avoid that $100 or $150 late fee, they'll take out one of these loans and accrue $5 or $10 of interest a day, and after 5 days, they'll pay it off. No prepayment penalty. They don't have to pay the interest that's out there. These folks are smart consumers, and they know
how. The refinanced amount covers all of the interest from the first loan.
Yes, and the FID's known about this because on the loan agreement it will say, let's say the first loan is $1,000, the second loan is $2,000. The loan agreement will show you are getting in cash $1,000, and we are using this other $1,000 to pay off the old loan. And so, again, this has been going on since 2007. My client actually took the exception loan under subsection 2 to the FID and said, we want to do this kind of loan. Is this lawful? Are you okay with this? And they said, yes. And that's in Mr. Anderson's declaration, which was undisputed.
Was the purpose of subsection 2 to avoid this kind of endless, I guess they just call it a debt treadmill type of thing where you're just constantly refinancing to pay off the old loans? And does the way that your client wants to do it, does that kind of circumvent that policy?
No, first of all, I disagree with the term debt treadmill, because if you look at the legislative history and when Senator Buckley spoke about this, the debt treadmill she was talking about was loans with an APR in excess of 200% and loans where there was a right to sue. I think she talked about the writ of garnishment trap or something like that, where there would be a judgment and then the costs would add on and on and on. That doesn't occur here. That's why we're all calling it an exception loan. This really doesn't fall under the debt treadmill. And as this court said in DLC 1, if there's no right to sue, that's the end. The customer defaults, and there is no recourse for my client other than, I suppose, credit reporting. But that's it. And again, these exception loans, the trade-off is there's no temporal limit, and there's no restriction on refinancing, but there are restrictions in terms of filing a lawsuit, and you have a much lower interest rate. That 200% APR is about a third of the state average. So that's why our client does it under this statute, under subsection 2.
Mr. Riley, can you clarify for me? We're talking about being able to have, like, I guess, serial subsection 2 loans, one replacing the other. Fine. But is the first of the subsection 2 loans replacing some prior loan under a different provision?
No, no, it's under this provision.
So the original loan to a borrower is being made under this subsection?
Correct, and this is what my client presented to the FID back in 2007 that they approved, and it's also discussed, I believe, in DLC 1, where there are...
Where in DLC 1 does it talk about that?
Let me pull it up here. At pages 115 through 116, we conclude that the plain language of NRS 604A.480(2) expressly permits a licensee to offer a new deferred deposit or high interest loan that is not subject to the 60-day restriction or principal adjustment prohibition of subsection 1. Continuing down, we further, this is on page 116 as well, we further conclude that if a licensee issues a new deferred deposit loan or a new high interest loan to a borrower in order to pay the balance of an outstanding loan on terms set forth in NRS 604A.482A, the licensee foregoes the right to file a civil action or institute alternative dispute resolution proceedings. So we've gone over this, I believe we've gone over this before. And I think the argument would have been at the time, if you couldn't refinance one of these loans, I think the FID's argument and the court's decision should have been, why are we talking about the right to sue? If you can't refinance these loans in any way, shape, or form, which is what the advisory opinion that's been enjoined, that's the subject of the injunction, the advisory opinion says you can never refinance these loans, that would have been the argument. That would have been the threshold argument. That argument was not made. And as a matter of fact, to the contrary, the FID said that page 282 of the appendix.
But they would argue, and I thought they did argue, like there could be other kinds of loans that are not under this particular section of the statute. There are the 35-day loans and things like that, right? So those loans could be made, and then there could be a subsection 2 loan that follows that, correct?
Correct, yes.
Okay. So the fact that there's a subsection 2 loan doesn't necessarily mean the only thing that preceded it could be another subsection 2 loan.
I agree with you. That really hasn't been briefed, but I presume that there are different loans, not just high interest loans, but deferred deposit loans, and I suppose even title loans, that could be refinanced under section 5057.
Right.
It's just that my client's loans are specific to subsection 2.
Right, but our holding in DLC 1 didn't, I don't read it as specifically saying that it is specifically allowing a subsection 2 loan to replace a subsection 2 loan.
Well, but that's baked into the entire decision. I mean, because that's what the whole decision was about refinancing of loans, not original loans.
If I could ask, under 5057, the sub 2 loans, if I understand it correctly, as a loan is approaching its maturity date, if it hasn't been paid off, but in your words, the client is paying and is trying to do a good job, you all reach out to them about refinancing?
Well, I suppose my client could, or the customer could.
Okay.
As well.
Okay. And so then they would refinance potentially with another sub 2 loan, and it kind of combines it into one thing.
Yes, exactly. Okay. I mean, and there's no gamesmanship here. I mean, Chapter 604A allows a licensee to issue a second loan or a third loan, and so refinancing.
To that point, though, I mean, you all could keep doing that, right?
Yes, because there's no temporal limit on these types of loans.
So whether it's 2 or 15 sub 2 loans, whatever it takes.
Correct.
What happens if a loan under sub 2 is reaching its maturity date and it isn't paid off in full?
Well, then it's in default, and that's the end of it. I mean, my client doesn't lend to a customer.
Well, that's the end of it, but under the statute, no more interest can accrue, right?
Correct, yes. Yeah, no more interest can accrue. It's a mature loan. And if it's in default, then there are other provisions under Chapter 604A that kick in. I think I want to say prime plus 10% interest is allowed, but the contract rate of interest doesn't continue to accrue past maturity.
Okay.
And that happens whenever there's a default.
Right.
If the default happens on day 10.
Okay.
With regard to the attorney's fees, well, actually, with regard to the absurd results doctrine, The absurd results doctrine is over argued. It's not intended to rewrite statutes. It's intended where we don't like a result or don't like theoretically a result. It comes into play when you have unintended consequences. And then we don't have unintended consequences here. And in fact, I don't know how you can enforce a statute one way for 15 years and then say that, well, the way we were enforcing it for 15 years was absurd. So I don't think that's a basis for the court to rewrite the statute. The court has a lot of options here in terms of how to address this, in terms of how to resolve the appeal. On the opening brief and the merits brief, the Financial Institutions Division did not raise or challenge Judge Williams' decision that they were collaterally estopped and judicially estopped from proceeding, and that their position was contrary to DLC-1's opinion. They did not raise that on appeal.
Well, they argued that they were allowed to change their position. Isn't that effectively responding to that?
Well, that's interesting, because at first they said that they were not arguing in contradiction to DLC-1. Then they admitted they were, but were allowed to try, you know, to change our opinion. I think they raised it for the purposes of attorney's fees, that we, the FID, should not have been sanctioned under NRS 18.0102B, but they did not raise it in the opening brief on the merits. And it was quite a lengthy part of our response and our summary judgment motion as well, and they simply ignored it. With regard to the attorney's fees, I heard the term prevailing party. We did not move for attorney's fees as a prevailing party. We moved for attorney's fees under NRS 18.0102B because I'll be as informal as I can here. Our argument to Judge Williams was that the FID was arguing out of one corner of its proverbial mouth before you, and then out of the other corner of its proverbial mouth in front of Judge Williams, and that's not appropriate. You can make good faith arguments, and our court system encourages aggressive and vigorous advocacy, but this court literally said you can refinance these types of loans. They argued here you can refinance these types of loans. And then in the advisory opinion, they said you can never refinance these loans. And they stuck to that argument in front of Judge Williams. And that's why he issued sanctions. It was not a Chapter 233B contested case. We were asking for fees because we feel that the government should not get a free pass on the equivalent of Rule 11, which is under NRS 18.010.
Generally speaking, what are kind of interest rates are applied in sub 2 loans? I know the statute says it has to be under 200%.
Well, the sub 2, our client, I believe, is just under the 200%. I don't know that a lot of other licensees issue loans under this statute, and that's why the average is 600% APR. It's really high. And so that's why my client works within this exception.
So is it better to refinance at another 200% or to default and pay?
Well, but it's not at another 200%, because you're only accruing interest for the time that the loan is not paid. So if you only keep the loan open for 5 days, you're talking about 200% APR divided by 365 times 5. So we're talking about $25 or $30 worth of interest for that loan. By the way, a lot of customers pay off their loans, come back 2 weeks later, and get a new loan. This was really about administrative convenience for our client and trying to keep consumers from being confused about carrying 2 or 3 loans at the same time, which is really not good for anybody, I don't think.
So when the subsection 2 loan is taken out to replace a prior, let's say a prior subsection 2 loan, so what's paid off for the prior subsection 2 loan is the principal and all of the then accrued interest?
Correct.
Okay, and that pays off the prior loan, and now whatever amount was taken on this new loan is now accruing interest go forward.
Yes, so for example, the interest that you'll see in the TILA box, which will have a very large number, that assumes that you're carrying the loan out for the full 13 months. A customer rarely actually pays that because they're only paying interest on what's accrued for the 2, 3, 4, 5 days or a week or 2 weeks. If the court has any other questions, I'd be glad to answer them. We ask that the court affirm the judgment in all respects, including the merits order and the fees order. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you. Thank you both.
She has time.
No, she doesn't have time.
Did I use my entire
time? Use all of your time, yeah.
I thought she had 16 seconds.
No.
No?
That was his 16 seconds.
So the matter is going to stand.